The headlines: a prominent Sunni cleric is found dead in Iran's southeastern province of Sistan and Baluchistan a day after he was kidnapped by Takfiri terrorists. Tehran criticizes Germany for inciting terrorism and hate speech in Iran while considering the fight against the same phenomena as a priority for its territory. Palestinians attend the funeral procession of a teenager who was killed during clashes with Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank on Thursday. Hello and welcome, everybody. Palestinians hold a funeral procession for a teenager killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. 16-year-old Daya Erhimi was killed in a village northwest of Ramallah on Thursday. Three Palestinians were also killed and several others injured on the same day during an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Friday was declared a day of public mourning in Jenin. Israeli forces have been escalating deadly attacks against Palestinians, killing some 150 this year alone across the West Bank. The resistance movement, Hamas, has reacted defiantly to the surge in Israeli violence. It says the regime will only make Palestinians more resolute in their resistance. Our West Bank correspondent, Mona Kandil, tells us more about how Palestinian resistance groups have reacted to the Israeli killing of their young compatriot.
Palestinian resistance groups have stressed that their option to resist, or the option to resist, is the only option left to them to respond to the ongoing Israeli crimes and aggression. Palestinian resistance groups have made it clear that the more Israeli military would be killing Palestinians in cold blood and even targeting Palestinian fighters, this would make Palestinians more resolved to continue the resistance, to fight the Israeli forces, and to stand against the illegal Israeli policies. Palestinians have been left alone. There are only condemnations from the international community, the European Union, but at the same time, Palestinians are being killed in cold blood without anything left to them. The Israelis don't want for the Palestinians to resist. They want to raid Palestinian areas and kill people, destroy their homes, arrest people from all walks of life, and at the same time, they don't want them to resist or to react to these crimes.
Prominent Sunni cleric Molavi Abdul Wahid Righi has been found dead in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Baluchistan province a day after he was kidnapped by Takfiri terrorists. Provincial officials say Righi was abducted at noon on Thursday after leaving a mosque in the city of Khosh. Officials say they have opened an investigation into the killing. The cleric had previously said that he was threatened by groups hostile toward the Islamic Republic. He made the remarks during a meeting with a delegation sent to the province by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Sistan and Baluchistan province has been the scene of foreign-backed unrest following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini. Back in September, she collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. On this segment of the program, Iran says fighting terrorism, violence, and hate speech is a clear international responsibility amid the Western criticism of its response to the riots in the country. The Iranian foreign minister singled out Germany's, quote, hypocritical and duplicitous stance on the unrest in Iran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Berlin considers such scourges as red lines for itself, but incites the same sinister phenomena in Iran and denounces Tehran's legitimate campaign against them. Germany has condemned Iran and summoned the Iranian ambassador. The UK and Canada have also slapped fresh sanctions on Iran, while the EU is also reportedly set to impose more bans on the country. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political commentator Mr. Said Mohsen Abbas, who's joining us from the British capital, London. We also have author and journalist Robert Fantina, who's joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Abbas in London, and let's jump right in. I want to get your thoughts on the recent comments coming from the Iranian foreign minister.
Well, it's a very natural reaction to a very hypocritical policy and stance taken up by the likes of Germany, Britain, and the rest of the the Anglo-Zionist Empire. The reality is that this is a premeditated set of acts, riots, the terrorism, the synchronized propaganda, the media propaganda that's gone with it. You know, these things don't just happen by accident. You'd have to be rather naive to the extreme to think that there wasn't some kind of preemptive coordination that is linking this, you know, this entire set of scenarios. And Germany, with its intelligence services and knowing full well what its relations are with the Americans, is fully aware of what goes on in terms of regime change policies that the Americans dictate. And Germany, being one of the most prominent you know, members of NATO, one of the most prominent members in the EU, has its financial interests tied so closely to the Americans that they're willing to even allow the demise of Europe within this whole war in Ukraine that you see and the whole energy crisis that's resulted. So Germany and its leaders are, first of all, acting criminally towards their own people, their own citizens. They're enacting policies which are detrimental to their own German folk. But when it comes to terror and the war on terror, of course, Germany is one of those flag wavers in terms of condemning ISIS and condemning all the kind of so-called Islamic terrorism. And they've got huge new terrorism laws all in place to stop such terror and such rioting. And they will come down like a ton of bricks on anybody who even dreams of doing such an action in Germany. And for them to, of course, sanction it, to ignore all of the evidence that exists on the ground, to ignore the fact that ISIS have been involved, to ignore the fact that the provinces are getting full arms supply and are being coordinated to try and create insurrections, and with this, especially their awareness of the fact that the MKO is serviced in Albania and such. You know, such forces are the ones that are operating on the ground, along with other terrorist organizations, Jundala. To ignore all that is criminal, to be honest, on the German part. But of course, they're having to toe the American line on maximum pressure. And this is all about bringing Iran to its knees by making it afraid that it can't even handle its own domestic situation, that it must capitulate on issues like JCPO and the nuclear deal, capitulate on its regional defense policies, capitulate, of course, on their ballistic missile programs, i.e. everything to do with defending Iran, everything to do with maintaining its sovereignty and independence must be given away in order for the Germans and the Americans and the UK to relax these kinds of absolutely abominable acts of which are against the UN Charter. They're blatantly, flagrantly trying to instigate regime change or government change, and that is by international law. It's absolutely preposterous. It's against any kind of human civilizational action. If Iran was to even try to do anything like that within any of these nations of Germany, Britain, and whatnot, they would immediately take Iran to some international courts and try to bring even more of their sanctions down on them. Iran doesn't do such things, yet it's regarded almost as an exceptionalism for Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-Western Zionist powers to do whatever they want, and that's what's happening here.
Robert Fantina, would you like to add anything to what Mr. Mohsen Abbas, our guest in London, just said? Also, do you agree with his assessment that this is in line with the maximum pressure campaign and maximum pressure policy against Iran?
Yes, I do agree. The United States wants regime change in Iran and will seize on anything to try to force that, including issuing sanctions, violating the JCPOA, and so on. I also want to comment on the hypocrisy that the Iranian foreign minister so correctly pointed out. Germany is criticizing Iran's policies, and yet it says nothing about Israel's brutal, ongoing, for decades, policies against the Palestinians. The killings of the Palestinians, the destruction of their homes, the destruction of their economy. Germany has full diplomatic relations with Israel and never says a word about that. And now when there's some internal unrest in Iran, it is immediately condemning the Iranian government. The same with Canada. Canada needs to get its act cleaned up regarding its treatment of indigenous people, within our borders. I'm in Canada. Before it starts criticizing anybody else for any alleged or genuine human rights violations. Canada is committing them on a regular basis against Indigenous people in Canada, and so is in no position to denounce any other country's behaviors until it does it about its own. This hypocrisy we see in certainly the United States, where people of color are imprisoned at a much higher rate, astronomically higher rate than whites, where racism is institutionalized, and yet the United States will criticize what's happening in Iran and what the Iranian government is doing. It is all, as your other commentator mentioned, it's all to bring about regime change so that a government that's compliant to U.S. demands, that will follow U.S. dictates, will be installed in Iran. That is not what the Iranian people want, and the blatant efforts of these other countries to bring that about are against in violation of international law, again, as your other commentator mentioned, and are unlikely to succeed because the Iranian people do not want another puppet government whose strings are pulled by the U.S.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from the British capital, London, author and journalist Robert Fantina, speaking to us from Kitchener, Ontario. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of News Arriba. Do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. Elsewhere, the Al-Quds International Institute has held a conference in the besieged Gaza Strip to shed more light on Israeli violations in Al-Quds and ways to confront the Judaization of the Holy City. Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israel plots to change its status. Our correspondent in Gaza, Asher Shannon, has this report.
A conference has been held in the Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is dubbed Judaization of Al-Quds and ways to confront it. Experts, academics, and senior Palestinian officials have attended the conference. They have discussed ways to tackle the growing Israeli violence against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This, as Israeli officials have been trying to Judaize the holy Muslim city of Al-Quds in the past by demolishing Palestinian homes and building illegal Jewish settlements.
We are holding this conference to support Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, and to reaffirm the Islamic identity of Al-Quds. Holding this event this year is of great significance amid the escalation of Zionist aggressions against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state. Speaking to Press TV, the Hamas movement asserted the Islamic and Arab identity of Al-Quds and refuted all Israeli claims to the holy city.
Al-Quds was never a state or a capital of a state for the Jews. All the history indicated that it was part of Palestine, and Palestine was and still is a part of the Arabic countries, which is a part of the Islamic world.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. Those who attended the conference slammed the normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Israeli regime.
I think that as Al-Quds is not just only for Palestinians, it's for Arabs and for Islamic nations. So why the Arabs now normalize the relation with Israel, and they do all their efforts against Palestinians?
In its final communique, the conference stressed the importance of protecting Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and has been turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Well, the Russian president has threatened to cut oil production in response to the Western price cap on the country's crude exports.
We will even maybe consider a possible, I'm not saying now that this is a definitive decision, but we will think about a possible reduction in production if necessary.
Putin was speaking at a news conference following a regional summit in Kyrgyzstan. He vowed that Moscow would announce retaliatory steps in the next few days. The Russian leader also slammed the price cap as a, quote, stupid decision, warning that the move is harmful to global energy markets. However, he stressed that the $60 price limit on Russia's seaborne oil isn't affecting his country. The restrictions are aimed at reducing Russia's ability to finance the war in Ukraine. Kiev has also reacted to the decision by calling the move ineffective and a weak position by its allies. Well, Greg Simons is a researcher at the Sweden-based Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies. He says the EU's price cap decision will come back to haunt the bloc itself.
The reality is they know it's going to bite them. I mean, they've been talking about how the US is deindustrializing Europe, which it is through these acts of stupidity, which these European bureaucrats are willingly doing for Washington. So, I mean, this is just a dog biting its own tail. And, I mean, it's going to go nowhere good. And, I mean, this has been proven. They know that their industry is going to go down. They know there's going to be a shortage of fuel. They know that the prices are going to go up. And that the rest of the world, beyond this little Eurocentric vision and the different vassal states which belong to this US configuration of this Western-centric world, do not agree with them.
Well, the European Union is to add more than $2 billion to fund used to help arm Ukraine, but this could face delays amid differences with Hungary. EU diplomats say a preliminary agreement has been struck among the 27 member bloc to bolster the European peace facility. The fund has already committed over 3 billion euros to cover the cost of weaponry for Kiev. The deal was set to be signed on Monday, but a standoff with Hungary over its own frozen EU funds may force Budapest to delay the approval. The EU has frozen Hungarian funds over the country's opposition to the bloc's sanctions on Russia and its refusal to support the war in Ukraine. Hungary argues that the EU is playing a dangerous game by providing Ukraine with destructive weapons, training Ukrainian soldiers and imposing sanctions on Russian energy.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, union boss Mick Lynch has announced new Christmas walkouts. Industrial action will take place from Christmas Eve to the morning of December 27th, causing chaos on British Rail. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Daily Mail has covered this story. MPs have slammed RMT union baron Mick Lynch for ruining Christmas after he sparked further festive chaos by announcing more strikes from December 24th to December 27th in new wave of walkouts to cripple train services this winter. Former Levelling Up Secretary Simon Clark called the decision dreadful, while Transport Secretary Mark Harper dubbed it disappointing. Union boss McLinch announced the additional dates this evening and reaffirmed the strikes in January. "I'm sure the travelling public will be really disappointed and irritated and angry," Mr. Lynch said at a press conference. But he added that there has been no improved offer presented to his union and that they have no choice as the current offer is extremely detrimental. Transport Secretary Mark Harper said, "It's incredibly disappointing that despite a new and improved deal offering job security and a fair pay rise, the RMT is not only continuing with upcoming industrial action, but has called more strikes over Christmas. The government has played its part by facilitating a fair and decent offer, but by instructing its members to reject it, the RMT has failed to play its part, and our rail network now faces more harmful disruption rather than helpful discussion." Simon Clark, the former Levelling Up Secretary, tweeted, "This is dreadful by the RMT ruining people's Christmas with an 8% pay rise over 2 years on the table and no compulsory redundancies." The railway received £16 billion, £600 per household in emergency funding during COVID, and drivers' median salary is £59,000. Staff's is £44,000. Members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, RMT, will walk out from 6 p.m. on Christmas Eve until 6 a.m. on 27th of December and will press ahead with two 48-hour strikes next week. The union announced it will put the latest offer from Network Rail to its members with a recommendation to reject it. The RMT said there had been no improved offer from the train operating companies, claiming they still awaited a mandate from the government. Strikes on 14 train companies will go ahead next week, although talks will be held with the Rail Delivery Group on Tuesday, 6th of December. Britain's struggling pubs, restaurants and hotels will lose a catastrophic £1.5 billion in sales during the Christmas strikes, which business bosses fear will cripple the hospitality industry. The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story and gives us more detail. A minister slammed the militant RMT Rail Union on Tuesday, 6th of December, for planning new strikes around Christmas. RMT boss Mick Lynch announced a fresh strike over Christmas in a further blow to beleaguered travellers on Monday evening, as he confirmed existing walkouts planned over the festive period would go ahead. Mr. Lynch said industrial action would take place from Christmas Eve to the morning of 27th of December. Strike action set to take place across four 48-hour periods on 13th and 14th of December, on 16th and 17th of December, as well as 3rd and 4th of January and 6th and 7th of January. Schools Minister Nick Gibb told GB News on Tuesday morning, "It's a very disappointing decision by the RMT union. They were offered a very good pay deal by the employers, 8% over 2 years, which is in line with the pay deals happening outside the public sector of between 4 and 6%. The unions really should call off this strike. It's inconveniencing people up and down the country in the run-up to Christmas. It's a very poor way of conducting negotiations. We would urge the unions to talk to the employers to keep negotiating and not to hold the country to ransom, particularly in December as we get nearer to Christmas." It is the most disruptive action announced by the union in a long-running dispute with rail bosses over pay and conditions amid the cost of living crisis. Passengers had already been warned to organise travel plans well in advance, as around 5% of the rail network will be shut down for engineering works over Christmas. Mick Lynch said He could understand how the travelling public would be really disappointed and irritated, but that the current offer from Network Rail was extremely detrimental to his members. We remain available for talks in order to resolve these issues, but we will not bow to pressure from the employers and the government to the detriment of our members, he said. Reacting to the announcement, Transport Secretary Mark Harper said, "It's incredibly disappointing that despite a new and improved deal offering job security and a fair pay rise, the RMT is not only continuing with upcoming industrial action, but has called more strikes over the Christmas period. It's especially disappointing given the TSSA union has described this new and improved deal as the best we can achieve through negotiation and called off strikes. The government has played its part by facilitating a fair and decent offer, but by instructing its members to reject it, the RMT has failed to play its part, and our rail network now faces more harmful disruption rather than helpful discussion." Housing Secretary Michael Gove said the government was not spoiling for any kind of fight with the unions. Michael Gove told Sky News, "We are determined to ensure we can work constructively with employers and trade unions to work through what is a difficult time." Meanwhile, McLinch also announced a new pay offer will be put to RMT members in a referendum with a recommendation to reject it. The referendum will close at noon on Monday, 12th of December, he said. A separate offer by the Rail Delivery Group, backdating a 4% pay rise for 2022 with the same again next year, has been rejected already by the RMT union.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of Back to Reality. This is Asma, your humble host. Once more, I have the privilege to be here with two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you, Sister Asma.
Thank you for being here.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you. Today I'm really happy that I have the honor to be here with you two and our dear listeners.
Thank you. And we have the pleasure to have you both in here.
Thank you.
Now, as the ritual of this program, I would like you to give us a very brief introduction about yourself.
All right. I am Zainab Askari, and I am done with Master's in Linguistics from Kashmir University, and then I came to Iran, and I'm studying in the seminary school right now.
So I wish you luck. And you, Sister Bita?
I'm Bita, a medical student, which I'm really interested in this sort of topic, which we discussed here.
It is the truth. There is no way to ignore death. Because one day, or I don't know, 1 hour, there would be this world without me.
If you allow me, I want to add something. You know, because my study field, I'm really attached to death. You know, because, you know, we're going to go to hospitals. And every day, there are even a group of families who are dead because of accidents and so on. And unfortunately, after a time that you see death a lot, you will be numb about it.
And, is it?
Yeah.
Is it like that?
As doctors, unfortunately, there are many doctors who actually have no feelings about someone being dead. And, they, you know, they look at it as a piece of meat, exactly like a piece of meat. You're a piece of meat.
But that's very, very
sad. That's really disastrous, I think, this feeling. And I'm really starting on this issue that, what is death? And for example, sometimes in medical issues, I am the one who would choose that person with that or not. And what are these, for example, medical development that we have that is delaying the time of death of people? What are all of these? And what are the way that we can, for example, make human beings somehow immortal? But sometimes I think about it in my imagination. And I think...
Will remain as in just imagination.
Thank you for your courage that you're giving me.
I will guarantee that for you.
Thank you for your frustration. But, you know, sometimes I feel like disastrous that if human being was immortal, that would be a disaster, I think.
Exactly. Now, I want to...
Sister Rita, have you... I think whatever I'm hearing from her conversation, yeah. I guess she reads a lot of near-death experiences. Do you?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's why she loves death, you know? Now. Because one of the common points is to us in all the near-death experience stories is that everyone who has experienced that says that all of a sudden, all stress was taken away from me. All of a sudden, all stress was taken away, and I was happy, I was enjoying. Yeah. And I met all those
people. I want to go experience it. Come on, save me.
So yeah, I think she has read a lot of near-death experience stories. That's why she loves to experience this.
Yeah. Now, let's keep it there at this very nice cliffhanger, and then we'll be back. Thank you, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. We're discussing death and how to make it sound a little better and not as scary, of course. You know what? I guess if there was no death, life would have got no meaning.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Because if there is no end to human greed, to human wishes, to human whatever effort they do, then there is no meaning in their life. Without death, we will never have any meaning in whatever that we do. Right.
And interestingly, that day, the day you leave this world, even those who hated you till yesterday, they love you that day.
Yeah, exactly. And they think like, okay, she were really amazing. And I don't know if she really
only remember
that.
Your good things.
Yeah, exactly.
Good things you did to them. So yes, death gives meaning. I agree to that.
Yeah, that is very true. And you know what? When we actually are going to, sometimes when we think about death, and then I constantly hear that, okay, the life in there is eternal and there's no end to it. That sounds odd to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We usually, as human beings who have been used to start at a point and then end at another point, then thinking about an eternal life is something very strange.
It is, I think.
Yeah.
I think the problem is that we are comparing our power with the power of God, you know.
Exactly,
and
it's
just a problem that we are actually challenging with about afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes you have to think about a point that if there were no death, you know, what would you be? Because from another perspective, you told me that, okay, we would feel numb and life would be meaningless or something. But from another perspective, you know, a human being has a special greed in itself, you know.
Exactly.
And because of this greed, if there were no death, it means that you feel so much powerful, more powerful than what you feel today. And this power that you feel in yourself would make you a monster, I think.
Exactly. I have constantly heard the elders making the prayers, oh Allah, take me from this world while I'm not dependent on others, while I'm not burdened on others. So, you know, if you imagine like you're not going to die ever, but with age, you're going to be more dependent on others.
Yeah.
You're actually going to be burdened on others. And I have often seen those great grandparents praying that, oh Allah, take me from this world without being burdened on others. Actually,
yeah,
they pray
true.
For a death.
So take me before I get old.
Me too. I have the same entry point of view. I don't want to get that much old.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very good. Before seeing the old age, too much of the old age,
exactly.
Then take us.
Well, time is not the fool of rosy cheeks and rosy
exactly.
lips.
Now the listeners must say the people in here are very much depressed and done with their
lives.
Exactly. No, it's not actually like that, but I guess.
I'd like one more thing. The point we were discussing at the starting of the discussion, why it sounds scary, is because I am aware of my deeds. Every person.
This is the very much important fact.
This like every person. Yeah. Not, I am not aware of all your deeds.
Yeah. Dark fact.
I'm not aware of your all deeds. Only the person himself or herself is aware of each and every minute thing she has done, he has done in the lifetime. Mm. And just because there are some dark parts, you don't want to go to that world. You're not ready. You know there's a transfer. Yeah. You know now you have this firm faith that it's my just body that's going to be,
decayed.
Buried.
Yes, that's going to be buried and I'm going to have a transfer into some other world. You have this firm faith. But why are you still scared? Why are you still scared? Why? You know there are no tensions in that world. There's no stress of job, earning money and other things.
But there's another thing we also know. We have to pay for every single thing we have did.
Exactly. They think, Miss Cole, I don't know.
For every single thing we have done.
The minute thing that you have not even imagined is being recorded.
Exactly, yeah.
And I know that.
As we have it in the Holy Book of Quran, whatever good and bad you have done, even if it is the tiniest thing in the world, you are going to pay for it. So this is the scary part of death, you know? You have to stand in front of a judge, in front of a fair judge, and then you have to justify, you have to acquit yourself.
Exactly, and I think this is the point.
Yeah.
And the gist of our conversation is that we have to be scared of this.
You added a very nice word to it, fair judge.
Yeah.
Because if he's going to forgive me over my sins, then he has to forgive all others, and that's not fairness. So she added a word, fairness, to God in terms of judgment. That was really that I have to be concerned about my the book of deeds, whatever.
Exactly.
I have done.
Yeah, that is the important thing. Death is a word that might have some depressing connotations, but it actually is not like that bad. Well, it is, but it's not that bad because it's something actual. It's going to happen one day. And we know that we're not going to live an eternal life.
Well, if Sister Asma and Sister Bita promises me that we are going to meet there.
Yes.
And we're going to be friends even there. Nice. So then it would sound even more tastier.
Exactly. Yeah, yes. Exactly. Think about this.
I will see you.
We could even get united in there. After the judgment is done, then we could get united in there. And this idea is actually one of the relieving points about death. You know, when I think that, okay, after death, I could meet my family again. I can have my friends again. And upon all of these things, you know, in our theology book, I remember there was a sentence that whenever I just remember that, it hits me, you know. It's very much shocking, interesting.
Tell us that.
And it's very much awkward. It said that you can never meet the Lord, but when you get there into the heaven, you would feel the satisfaction that he has towards you and also the satisfaction you have with him. So this is very interesting, you know. We can never, it's like, you know, you love someone, you can never meet him, but you would feel him forever. And you would feel that he is there just right beside you.
So that's this is so a feeling.
Yes, it is very nice and very interesting. And I guess this is another positive point of death.
It is.
Because in Surah Al-Shiqaq as well, we have, after so many swearings, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that, you know, tabakan an tabak, stage by stage, you are moving ahead towards the meeting with me.
Yeah.
And in another, again, after so many swearings and other things, he puts very much emphasis on this verse, probably verse 19 of the same surah, that you are very close to your death. You, the step by step, the days you are actually passing on, the time that is going. Yeah. Or in another surah, Surah Asr, that it swears by the time that you are spending, you are in loss. And just, you know, think about, you know, all those swearings in Quran are actually a blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the sign of his merciness that he is telling us, hey man, you're going to meet me.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to taste
and
death.
And then we have it in another place, we have it that when a person is dying and then our soul is getting out from our body, nobody is close to us. Nobody is knowing what we're going through, but Allah is closer to us even from the veins.
Jugular vein.
Yeah. So he is going to be that close to us in those moments. We're not left alone.
I'm saying that we know death is there and we are ignorant towards it. But still Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala swears so much in Quran and then gives us a wake-up call. Remember death. Yeah. Remembrance of death is very important. In Surah Taqasur as well. You are seeing so many graves. Doesn't anything happen to you? Don't you remember death?
Remembrance of death is the remembrance of God.
Exactly.
You know, and that's just the point.
Yeah. Remembrance of death is the thing that is going to help us improve our deed. And then when we improve our deed, we're going to have much reliance and assurance in Allah. And then we would no longer feel so much scared of death.
And that deed would actually make you help get your book of deeds in your right hand. And we see so many verses that say, you'll get book of deeds in your right hand or in your left hand. When we say in right hand, you're going to meet face to face. When we say you're going to get book of deeds in your left hand, that means you're going to have a meeting from behind.
Yeah.
You're not going to meet face to face.
I wish a right hand for you both.
Yeah, me too.
I wish that for you too.
We wish we could meet there together again. But then, as for today's episode, everything is over. Time is passing. See that quickly everything is going to end. All of a sudden, we have to say goodbye to all the loved ones. And then also, there was a poetry. I loved it very much. And it is very true, I suppose. It says, do not come at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. And that is actually the gist of whatever we talked about. Death is not going to be an ending point. It is just the start of a new journey. Death is not going to be the end of us. And I guess as we grow older, we understand this by every single cell in our body. And we're going to have much insurance in Allah. And then everything is going to be easier for us. So departure is always difficult and it has a bitter taste. But it is something fatal and it's going to happen one day. And if you think about the other world and getting united with your loved one in there and having a life which is going to be eternal, then death is not going to sound as bitter as it sounds when you do not think about it properly. So that's it. I wish you have a good time. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك Let us see daylight again, once again.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
After beating Spain to reach the quarterfinals of the World Cup, the Moroccan national team players raised the Palestinian flag to celebrate their victory. Footage on social media showed a number of Moroccan players raising the Palestinian flag alongside their own Moroccan one, taking a group photo with the Palestinian flag on the pitch following the end of the match. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, fans from around the world supporting their national teams along with other soccer fans at the Qatar World Cup have displayed their strong opposition toward the fake regime of Israel in another slap in the face for the occupying regime. The increasingly vast number of videos going viral on social media show a rising number of nationals from around the world supporting their own different international teams, have been avoiding, intruding, shouting, and even shoving Israeli journalists. Other videos showed loud disruptions of Israeli live broadcasts by football supporters from around the globe, chanting pro-Palestine slogans. In one of the latest such videos that have been doing the rounds on the internet, an England fan shocked an Israeli World Cup reporter in Qatar by shouting, "Free Palestine" during a live TV broadcast. The video shows the England supporter Harry Hatton being interviewed by the Israeli journalist after the English national team beat Senegal 3-0 when he screamed, "It's coming home," but more importantly, "Free Palestine." The phrase "It's coming home" is the reference to a song released when England was hosting its first major football tournament, the 1996 UEFA European Football Championship, since the national team won the 1966 World Cup. The Israeli reporter can be seen shaking his head and raising his hand in frustration as Hatton and his three friends, all of whom were wearing English football shirts, cheered in support. Following a wave of online support for Hatton, the England fan later wrote in a social media post, "I am glad I got to play my small part in highlighting this issue." Another sports reporter for the Zionist regime's Channel 13 said he has been shoved, insulted, and accosted by fans during his live reports from the tournament. "You are killing babies," fans yelled as they rammed into him during a broadcast. The Israeli journalist says he is now advising Israeli visitors to hide any of their Israeli identity so as not to provoke hostility. He also says that when a cell phone salesman noticed his friend's settings were written in Hebrew, the salesman exploded with anger, screaming at the Israeli to get out of Doha, let alone his cell phone store. "I was so excited to come in with an Israeli passport, thinking it was going to be something positive," the journalist said, adding, "It's sad, it's unpleasant, people were cursing and threatening us." Israeli journalists, who are the most visible symbols of their regime at the world's most popular tournament, have also been angrily scolded at or ignored by local residents, as well as fans from Arab and Islamic world. This has served as a reminder for the apartheid regime that despite signing the 2020 normalization deals with three Persian Gulf Arab kingdoms, ordinary citizens in those kingdoms and the wider region have deep animosity toward the Zionist regime and strongly oppose any relations with it. The Qatar World Cup has also highlighted the unity among Arab and Islamic visitors to Doha in their support for Palestine and anger toward the Zionist regime. This is something that regional conferences also focus on, but do not grab any attention from the global mainstream media. Fans supporting different teams are wearing armbands and other symbols of Palestine, waving flags in support of the Palestinian cause. They also have chanted songs in support of the Palestinians at multiple venues, with some stadiums seeing massive Palestinian flags on display at the stands. A man wearing a Tunisia shirt interrupted the game by running onto the field with a Palestinian flag. Another case involved Tunisian fans raising a huge Free Palestine flag during their game against Australia. Violence has erupted in the occupied West Bank this year, and just hours after news emerged that a number of Palestinians were shot dead in the West Bank, Arab fans at the World Cup in Qatar chanted in Arabic, "With the spirit and blood, we will redeem you, O Palestine." Before the World Cup began, FIFA announced that fans from Israelis, settlers squatting on occupied Palestinian territories, would be allowed to fly directly to Qatar for the World Cup from the occupied Palestinian territories for the first time. The indigenous Palestinians from the occupied Palestinian territories have also been allowed to travel to Doha by military occupation. Qatari officials have a history of public support toward the Palestinian cause and have insisted the temporary opening of its airways to Israelis was purely to comply with FIFA hosting requirements, not a step to any form of a move toward normalizing ties. The Qatari government says that Doha has informed Israeli officials that any escalation in Al-Quds, the besieged Gaza Strip, or the occupied West Bank during this time will risk the cancellations of the agreement, including the direct flights. If anything, the World Cup in Qatar has highlighted the failure of the so-called Abraham Accords, an agreement brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, that normalized relations between the fabricated regime of Israel and the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. It comes amid protests across Bahrain against a visit by the Zionist regime president Isaac Herzog to the Persian Gulf Arab Kingdom for the first time. This is despite a heavy crackdown on protests in the kingdom, which protesters have defied, signaling the Bahraini citizens' strong opposition toward the ruler's decision to normalize Manama's ties with the Zionist regime. Earlier this year, a public opinion survey in the region found that the people of West Asia are overwhelmingly opposed to any form of normalization deal with the Zionist regime. The annual Arab Opinion Index, AOI, published by the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies, found that more than 85% of its 28,000 respondents opposed any diplomatic recognition of Israel. Just 6% of those polled said they would support such a move. Surveys in Sudan show almost 80% of the country's citizens who responded to polls said they also oppose any form of normalization. Any attempts to try to maintain some kind of illusion that the so-called Abraham Accords were anything other than a military and trade agreement between an apartheid entity and a few monarchies in the Persian Gulf is facing serious barriers. Nowhere has this been more evident than during the World Cup in Qatar, where the support for Palestine has been on full display and the disgust at the Israeli apartheid regime has hit international headlines. As witnessed in Doha, support for the Palestinian cause goes beyond West Asia region. It has stretched to the populations of people from around the world. The harassment of Israeli journalists at the World Cup by supporters of international teams is a drop in the ocean in comparison to the harassment of Palestinians by the Zionist regime. Palestinians who are living under a strict military occupation, The war crimes and genocidal campaigns, along with the mass murder of children, cannot be compared. Nevertheless, it has been a deeply embarrassing World Cup event for the Zionist regime and a PR campaign that has spectacularly backfired. The Palestinian flags waved at the World Cup and the chants in support of the Palestinian cause at the international tournament reflect the fact that Palestine has become a symbol of freedom among the free people in the world. On the other hand, over the past decade, footage showed that Israeli regime flags have been waved at white supremacist rallies in the United States and UK, among other Western states. This is while chants in support of the Zionist regime have been heard at extremist neo-Nazi rallies in Western Europe marching on the streets. Just think the irony. Also, the website of Palestinian Chronicle wrote the Moroccan national team, known as the Atlas Lions, made history when they won against Spain, one of the world's leading national football teams. Hakim Ziyech and his squad played a mostly defensive game with a strategy that relied mainly on the counterattacks. With such international football stars Ziyech, Ashraf Hakimi and Morocco's legendary goalkeeper Yassine Bounou, the Atlas Lions succeeded in reaching the end of the match without conceding any goals, considering that Spain had the most of the possession. It was in the penalty shootout that Moroccan players truly shined. Amid loud cheers and songs for Morocco and Palestine by tens of thousands of fans in Doha's Education City Stadium, the Moroccan team circled the field carrying the Palestinian and Moroccan flags. Like millions of Arabs, Palestinians tuned in to watch the Moroccan Lions make history. Palestinian journalist and editor of the Palestine Chronicle, Ramzi Barut, said in this regard, "Those who say that politics and sports do not mix know very little about the representation of football on the collective aspirations of people in the Middle East and around the world. To see Palestinians cheering for Morocco and Moroccans cheering for Palestine is one of the most significant Arab popular rejections of normalization with Israel," Barut added.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.